Du lytter til Radio 24/7. Den originale taleradio.
Velkommen til Aflyttet med Anders Kjærulf.
Velkommen til et program, der iført skæg og blå briller, i hvert fald indeni, hvor der den her uge falder en masse blinde, dumme, unge mennesker rundt sammen med deres smartphones, mens verden begraver dem i digitalisme. Manden bag det ubehagelige billede, det er hjerneforskeren Manfred Spitzer fra Tyskland, og han står bag et meget uvelkommen budskab i disse tider. Han siger, at børn og unges brug af computer gør dem dummere, ikke klogere, at der ikke findes nogen former for bevis for, at digital læring giver dem noget som helst, og hans anbefaling til alle lyder, stå imod til jul, køb absolut ingen smartphones, tablets eller PlayStation til dit afkom, de må ikke røre ved dem, før de er blevet over 18. Det kan godt være, de bliver sure, men de vil takke dig senere. Den historie, den vender vi tilbage til. Her i studiet har vi besøg af Mikkel Flyverbom, professor i kommunikation og digitale forandringer på Copenhagen Business School. Du er heller ikke helt vanvittigt tryg ved fremtiden i det her digitaliserede Danmark. Hvorfor er du ikke det?
Min bekymring går mere på, at vi måske ikke helt har forstået, hvad det er for nogle konsekvenser, der er den udvikling, vi ser. Altså, vi taler om digitalisering, og vi taler om, at det offentlige skal blive bedre til at bruge teknologi, og virksomheder skal blive bedre til det. Men i virkeligheden tror jeg, vi skal flytte fokus hen imod nogle langt større spørgsmål, som handler om, hvad det er for et samfund, vi er i gang med at opbygge, osv.
Det skal vi tale meget mere om. Altså, det bliver også noget omkring, der hedder, hvad kan man sige, omkring forhold mellem dataetik versus datapolitik. Det bliver om lidt her i programmet, der kalder sig for aflyttet, som er din knuste retina-skærm med billeder fra det overvågningssamfund, som vi alle sammen bor i. Jeg hedder Anders Kjærulf. Velkommen til.
Even now, orders are being shouted into telephones, and men with guns will soon be on their way.
It's Chancellor Sutler.
And the truth is, there is something terribly wrong with this country, isn't there?
Du er inde i Aflyttet på Radio 24/7. Vi er i gang med endnu et program om, hvor galt det hele står til. Og før du siger, nu må det altså være nok, vi skal være en lille smule mere konstruktive, så minder jeg lige om, at der faktisk er meget lidt kritik eller reel debat omkring udviklingen i samfundet, især ikke om den digitale, der på mange måder betragtes og i talesættes som en globaliseret, disruptiv naturkraft, som vi ikke kan stå imod. I foråret, der mente Erhvervsministeriet så alligevel, at vi måske skulle tænke lidt dybere over, hvad vi sådan går og gør. Og i sidste uge, der udkom ministeriets ekspertgruppe med en rapport om dataetik. Den indeholder 9 konkrete anbefalinger, blandt andet om nedsættelse af dataetisk råd. I nogle gange velkommen til Mikkel Flyverbom, professor i kommunikation og digitale forandringer på Copenhagen Business School. Du har skrevet en klumme i Politikken under overskriften, regeringens dataeksperter har tænkt alt for snævert. Allerførst, hvad mener du med det?
Jeg mener med, at den pointe, det er, at rapporten jo langt hen ad vejen reducerer dataområdet til at handle om etik og konkurrencefordele. Altså, det bliver en diskussion om, hvordan kan vi bruge mere etiske tilgange til anvendelsen af data og behandlingen af data som et afsæt for at skabe mere tillid til virksomheder osv. Og pointen i klummen er bare, at vi bliver nødt til at tænke på det her område som meget større, som noget, der har langt mere vidtrækkende konsekvenser og ikke kan reduceres til etik og konkurrencefordele.
Det er noget større, vi skulle have snakket om. Altså, men det er en af de ting, vi allerede lever i Danmark, det er, at vi er et af verdens mest digitaliserede lande. Det er i hvert fald det, man siger. Digitaliseringsstyrelsen har man prallet med, vi er nummer 1 i digitalisering, det siger de gang på gang på gang. Og vi skal digitaliseres endnu mere i de kommende år. Hvordan definerer du som professor i digital forandring, og hvad er digitalisering for noget?
Jamen, digitalisering er jo et af de begreber, vi har prøvet at bruge for at ligesom indfange den her proces med, at teknologi og kommer til at fylde mere og mere i vores samfund. Men ligesom de andre begreber, vi brugte tidligere, så er det også værd at miste sin mening, eller det er i hvert fald svært at ligesom holde fast i et begreb som digitalisering. Så før i tiden talte vi om internettet som den her enhed et eller andet sted, eller vi talte om cyberspace som det her nye område, man kunne bevæge sig ind i og logge på og gå ud af igen osv. Og digitalisering er så et forsøg på at indfange, hvad der sker, når de her teknologiske processer begynder at væve sig tættere ind i samfundet og bliver installeret i alle vores virksomheder, i vores skoler, i det offentlige osv. Men jeg synes egentlig ikke, digitaliseringsbegrebet er så godt, altså fordi vi ser nok hellere til at tale om samfundet, om organisationerne osv., fordi digitalisering også lidt lyder som noget, der ligesom skal tages udefra og sættes ind i nogle virksomheder. Og langt hen ad vejen er teknologi og efterhånden blevet en form for ryggrad i stort set alle dele af vores samfund. Så jeg tror også, det begreb har sin udløbsdato.
Vi skal til at begynde at tale om, hvordan vi bruger computer i samfundet, i stedet for om digitalisering måske. Ja, det kunne være, måske være en vej, hvad vi kunne gøre det på.
Ja, eller hvad det er for et samfund, vi er i gang med at opbygge, og hvad det er for nogle valg, vi tager i forhold til helt centrale dele af vores samfund, som ikke bare handler om teknologi, fordi teknologi er på en måde allerede blevet vævet så tæt sammen, at vi ikke kan skille tingene ad længere.
Jeg kan huske de gode gamle dage, når man begyndte at snakke om cyberspace, der forestillede man sig, det var sådan noget med, at man tog sådan en stor dragt på, og så satte man sådan en sap, og så var man inde i et eller andet fantastisk univers, hvor man skulle flyve rundt og hacke hinanden og gøre alt muligt andet. Og min personlige erfaring der er, at jeg mener faktisk, det endte med, at cyberspace, det er nu det, der sidder inde i min mobiltelefon, og det er virkelig det, jeg sidder og kigger ind i, hver gang jeg tager den op til hovedet. Det er i hvert fald sådan, som jeg opfatter det. En af konsekvenserne af den her digitalisering, som er det ord, rammeord, der stadigvæk bliver brugt, og som du ikke er så glad for, det er det, som du kalder for datafisk. Hvad er det for noget?
Jamen, det handler jo om, at som et resultat af, at de her teknologier er blevet så sammenvævet med den måde, vi lever på og arbejder på osv., så begynder en masse aktiviteter at tage en dataform. Altså, vi begynder, hver gang vi går gennem byen, så på vej herhen efterlod jeg en masse spor i form af GPS-indikationer eller telemaster, min telefon lukket på osv. Så der er en masse sociale aktiviteter, der begynder at tage form som data.
Vi skaber simpelthen data hele tiden.
Og det er det her begreb datafisering prøver at indfange. Altså at en masse menneskelige aktiviteter og teknologiske aktiviteter efterlader de her spor og bliver noget, vi kan bruge som afsæt for at forstå, hvem vi er, hvad vi interesserer os for, hvor vi bevæger os hen osv. Så det er det, datafisering prøver at indfange. Og det handler jo om et skridt fra at ligesom gøre noget analogt, altså en bog, til noget, der har en digital form. Datificering er ligesom næste skridt, at de ting, der ligger i den bog, kan bruges til alt muligt. Man kan forstå, hvad folk har skrevet om gennem tiden ved at søge ned i det digitale indhold, der ligger i bøger, hvis vi digitaliserer dem osv. Så det er jo det her med, at der opstår en helt ny form for ressource, som vi ikke rigtig har forstået, hvad kommer til at betyde, og hvordan vi skal håndtere, og det er jo derfor, vi får de her diskussioner om dataetik og så videre.
Jamen, altså en af de ting, der vel også er med det her med de her datificeringer, altså det, vi skaber data hele tiden, det er jo også, det nye er vel, at de data er noget, der bliver samlet op, ligesom uden at vi bliver spurgt først. Det er typisk bare sådan noget med, at vi går rundt, du går rundt her i byen, og så smider du en masse dataspor, og dem er der nogen, der samler op, og det tænker vi ikke rigtig over, og vi kan heller ikke rigtig huske, om der er nogen, der har spurgt os om det. Mm-hmm. Det sker uden, at vi tænker over det.
Og det er jo fordi, vi ikke har ligesom fået et ordforråd, der kan hjælpe os med at forstå, hvad det her indebærer, og hvordan vi skal gå til det her fænomen. Altså langt hen ad vejen er det blevet set som noget, som en eller anden et råstof, som dem, der er gode til at hive det op af jorden, eller hive det ud af telefonerne, kan bruge til det, I vil. Altså en eller anden kommercielt råstof. Og i virkeligheden skal vi jo til at tænke på det, også på andre måder. Og de her diskussioner om dataetik er et forsøg på at sige, at det er også privat ejendom. Det tilhører de mennesker, der laver de data. Og på længere sigt skal vi nok også tale om, hvordan vi kan blive bedre til at have det som en form for samfundsressource eller et fælles gode, som bliver noget, vi på en eller anden måde kan udvikle teknologier gennem, som vi kan bruge til at også løse mange af de problemer, vi står overfor. Altså der er jo masser af fantastiske muligheder i data i forhold til sundhed, i forhold til hvordan byen kan optimeres og så videre. Så det er jo noget med at ligesom få tænkt ud over det her med, at det er et råstof for kommerciel aktivitet eller en privat ejendom, men også et eller andet samfundsgode.
Ja. Erhvervsministeriet, de barslede så i sidste uge med en rapport, der hed Data og om dataetik, og der var en række anbefalinger omkring, hvordan vi ligesom fik mere af det. Forkvinden fra ekspertgruppen, som er min højtærede kollega Christiane Vejlø, hun udtalte blandt andet, ansvarlig brug af data vil være absolut afgørende for danske virksomheder i fremtiden. Vi har kulturen til at gå forrest, vi har innovationskraften til at kombinere det teknologiske fremskridt med ansvar. Vi har kritiske forbrugere, som i højere og højere grad vil efterspørge både produkter og virksomheder, som har dataetik dybt forankret i kulturen. Hvad synes du om den rapport?
Jeg synes, det er rigtig godt, at vi får en rapport, der sætter fokus på det her område, og at de diskussioner, der har foregået i andre sammenhæng, altså i dansk sammenhæng, i Data Ethics, som er den her tænketank, og i udenlandsk sammenhæng i alle mulige forskellige fora, at de ligesom bliver samlet sammen og bliver serveret på en måde, så de kan spille ind i diskussionerne om data i Danmark. Og det er dygtige folk, der sidder med den gruppe, så det er klart, at der er mange gode ting ved den rapport, som er vigtige at få frem.
Nu er det, som en af konsekvenserne af det her, den her rapport, det er jo, at der skal nedsættes et dataetisk råd. Det synes du, det der med dataetik, det har du det lidt blandet med, kan jeg forstå.
Problemet med rapporten er nok, at den lige fra starten har været fokuseret meget snævert på det her med dataetik og forholdet mellem dataetik og konkurrencefordele. Altså, vi skal bruge dataetik som en måde at skabe tillid, så borgerne eller kunder går til de virksomheder, som ligesom flager med, at de behandler data ordentligt. Og det reducerer en kæmpestor problematik til nogle meget, meget få parametre eller nogle meget få punkter, som handler om at ligesom få virksomheder til at dokumentere, at de er gode til at håndtere data på etisk vis, og dermed skabe tillid, og dermed opbygge konkurrencefordele og få flere kunder osv. Og det er jo handler lidt om, at vi laver nogle opskrifter for den måde, vi skal løse vores samfundsproblemer på, som er ret snævre i det. Altså, vi kan sige, at dataområdet eller dataproblemer kan løses gennem etik, eller at vi skal have algoritmer til at være gennemsigtige, sådan så vi kan se, hvordan de arbejder og fungerer osv., og så har vi ligesom løst problemerne. Og der tror jeg bare, at vi har behov for nogle meget mere fundamentale og nogle meget, meget større visioner, altså fundamentale diskussioner og nogle større visioner for det her område, som går langt ud over at tale om, hvad der er etisk forsvarligt eller uforsvarligt.
Altså, jeg mener jo også, det er en meget morsom diskussion på den der måde, fordi jeg mener, at data som sådan kan vel ikke være etiske på den måde. De er indsamlet, i hvert fald med mindre man, og så kan man sige, at de er indsamlet på en etisk måde, men data er vel egentlig ligeglade med, om de er etiske data eller ej. Det kommer an på, hvordan vi bruger dem. Noget af det, du slår til lyd for, det er, at vi i stedet for en data etik skal snakke om datapolitik, og du så gerne, at vi fik et datapolitisk råd. Hvad vil den store forskel være der?
I virkeligheden gør det måske ikke så meget, om vi kalder det dataetik, eller om vi kalder det datapolitik, så længe vi sørger for, at dagsordenen og den institution eller det råd får en eller anden position, som gør, at den kan tænke på tværs af de eksisterende organisationer, der håndterer det her, at vi ikke får ligesom skabt dataetik som en meget, meget smal lille dagsorden, der handler om lidt ligesom vi har set ved smiley-ordninger eller CSR-rapporter, hvor du ser masser af virksomheder som Danske Bank osv., som skriver alle mulige fine CSR-statements med den ene hånd, og så hvidvasker på fuld løs, på fuld drøn med den anden hånd osv. Så det er jo noget med at få skabt en langt større dagsorden, som handler om, at vi skal tænke på data som noget, der kommer til at flette sig ind i alle dele af vores samfund. Ikke bare noget, som virksomheder skal håndtere etisk, men noget, som vi som vores offentlige institutioner og vores borgere og skolebørn og alle mulige andre bliver nødt til at forholde sig til, og vi bliver nødt til at udvikle nogle rammer og nogle spilleregler osv. på det her område. Så det er derfor, jeg synes, at datapolitik giver mere mening end dataetik, fordi datapolitik også vil gøre det muligt måske at få integreret det arbejde, der sker i datarådet, datatilsynet osv., så få skabt en større politisk dagsorden.
Vi håber, den kommer til at udvide sig. Jeg skal lige spørge dig her til sidst, sådan, har du børn?
Jeg har børn, ja.
Du har børn. Hvad med, har de nogle smartphones?
Det har de.
Hvor gamle er de?
De er 14 og 16.
Hvornår fik de deres smartphone først?
Det gjorde de, da de var sådan 8-9 år, tror jeg. Sikkert alt for tidligt i forhold til næste indslag.
Ja, og så den så vil jeg sige mange tak til Mikkel Flyverbom, professor i kommunikation og digital forandringer på Copenhagen Business School. Og grund til, at jeg spurgte dig om de her ting, det var fordi, at Danmark lige har haft besøg af en hjerneforsker, der mener, at børn de tager alvorlig skade af den her digitalisering, som vi lige har siddet og talt om. De slet ikke tåle at bruge digitale dimser som smartphones og tablets. Forskeren, som jeg skal huske at sige, er selvfølgelig også kontroversiel og laver en masse ballade rundt omkring. Han hedder Manfred Spitzer. Han er professor i psykiatri ved Ulm Universitet i Tyskland, og så har han skrevet bogen Digital Demens, der netop er blevet oversat til dansk. Jeg mødte ham i en hotellobby i København og lagde mærke til, at han af alle mennesker havde et Apple-ur på.
I can see you're using an Apple Watch. What are you using it for?
Just for telling me the time. It's actually a bit broken, so it can only tell the time, but nothing but that.
It's true. Don't even measure your blood pressure.
No, it doesn't measure anything. I can't even use it as a phone. It's just a time telling machine, and this is what I use it for.
Manfred Spitzer har et Apple Watch, men det duer ikke. Det er ikke forbundet til noget. Det måler ikke hans puls, og det kan ikke bruges til at tage telefoner med. Det eneste, det kan lave, det er at vise tiden. Og det har Spitzer det fint med. Han er bekymret over demens. Ikke hans egen, men hele verdens. Og den demens, som han er bekymret for, den er digital.
Well, the idea behind my use of digital dementia is quite easy. Dementia is literally mental decline, D down man's mind. So for every decline, there is a simple truism. The higher you start, the longer it takes you to get down. And if you start low, you're right there, okay? So your mind develops during childhood, adolescence, and young adulthood. And during this time, you undergo education, and you get basically mental training. And I don't mean just academic education. I mean, you learn how to walk and to talk and about the world, and you can behave properly. Your motor system develops fully to do all kinds of acrobatics or soccer or who knows what. So your brain gets really up to speed by using it, okay? And digital dementia, that phrase that struck me, when you realize that for every mental client, it really depends how well educated and well developed your brain got at young age, when you start to go down again, okay? If you ended up high during your education in young years, you can go down for a long time and still be high up. So you will eventually become demented, but you will die before that, okay? And if your brain development didn't reach a higher point, and your brain for some medical diagnosis like Alzheimer's disease or multi-infarct disease, okay, declines, and you haven't been way up, then you will be down again. In fact, the medical literature on dementia clearly says that there are some preventive factors like eating right, blueberries and broccoli are good, and exercise is good, but the number one positive factor is your education, the education that you attained early in life. That's the number one protective factor against the development of any form of dementia. And once you understand that, and you understand that digital media interfere with proper brain development and proper education, then you know that having interfered with your education and your brain development will be contributing to you getting dementia earlier. And this is what I call digital dementia.
Digital demens er ligesom demens. Demens, det kommer gradvist, og hvor hårdt angrebet du bliver af det, og hvor meget den påvirker dig, det afhænger i den grad af, hvor godt dit hoved fungerer, når det begynder. Populært sagt, siger Spitzer, så kan du godt få en demens, der reelt set først vil betyde noget, når du er 150 år gammel, og der er du alligevel død. Problemet er, siger han, at nutidens børn og unge ikke får deres hjerner ordentligt udviklet i den digitale verden, hvor de ikke behøver at huske noget. Unge mennesker og børn, der har hele vidensbanken i mobilen, de er derfor dårligt rustet til at blive klogere. Og når den rigtige demens, den sætter ind, så kommer det til at gå ned ad bakke med ekspresfart, hævder han.
The reasons behind it, digital media are a distraction. So your time on task goes down if you use a digital device concurrently during education. Also, digital media are not helpful in training executive function, in training language, in training social behavior. You can't learn empathy from a screen. You need to interact with real people. You can't learn your mother tongue from a screen. You need to interact with real people. So digital media are actually hindering education. And in fact, there are so many studies showing that if you introduce computers in schools, learning will decrease. It will not increase. So we know that by now. And once we know this, I think it's important that we stop digitizing schools. Germany, it's pretty bad right now. We are about to spend $5 billion to digitize our schools, which is going to result in noticeable less learning across the country in Germany. So we are spending $5 billion to make our kids worse in school. That's not a good idea.
Digitale medier distraherer, siger Manfred Spitzer. De virker ikke i forhold til at udvikle empati eller sprog. Det er evner, der kræver, at man interagerer med andre mennesker. Vi ved allerede nu, at digitale hjælpemidler i skolerne er kontraproduktive. Man lærer ganske enkelt mindre end før, og alligevel har man tænkt sig at bruge yderligere 5 milliarder euro på det i Tyskland, ud fra devisen, at så har vi nok ikke gjort det godt nok, siger altså Spitzer. Herhjemme i Danmark, der ved vi faktisk også godt, at digitalisering i undervisningen ikke virker. I en rapport fra 2012, bestilt af den daværende regering, der hed det blandt andet, at trods den massive danske IT-indsats i uddannelsessystemet, ja, så lå de danske unge i alderen 16-25 år, deres IT-evner, de lå under gennemsnittet i henhold til en international PISA-undersøgelse. Man konstaterede også, at de, der klarer sig værst i den digitale skole, det er de svage elever, de der faktisk har været hovedargumentet for at indføre digitale elementer som iPads og smartboards i skolerne.
From my experience discussing this, people will say, okay, if they don't learn math or languages or biology with computers, they need to learn to use computers in school. The problem is we don't have even a study showing that if they use computers in schools, they learn to use computers in schools. And the studies we have show that it doesn't work. We have two large-scale studies in Germany. One is called 1,000 times thousands computers in school bags, and the other is called the Hamburg Netbook Project. Both studies were large-scale studies funded by the German Research Ministry. They were done in 8th graders and 10th graders. And both studies found no effect of computer and internet use in schools on the kids' capability of computer and internet use. So even if you say, well, we have to do this and educate kids in schools how to use computers and the internet, the fact is we have tried to use computers and the internet in order for just doing that, and it didn't work. So if they had shown that it works, we can educate kids in schools, use computers, well, I would say, yes, they'll do it. But they have shown they can't. That's all I know, and I know more recent studies with the same effects. And again, I wrote 4 books on this subject, and I overview about 2,500 research papers on these subjects. And I'm not aware of a single research paper showing that computers in schools do any good to learning. Not a single one.
Hvis man forbyder smartphones i skolerne, så bliver børnene dygtigere. Det er et faktum, siger Manfred Spitzer, der sammenligner udrulningen af digitale dimser i skolerne med medicinalfirmaer, hvis patienter dør, og reaktionen på det er, at vi fikser det undervejs. Og for at gøre det endnu værre, så viser det sig faktisk, at det ikke engang børnenes evne til at bruge computer bliver bedre af flere computer i skolerne, tværtimod. Der er ikke et eneste stykke videnskab, der kan bevise, at der er en positiv sammenhæng her, siger altså Manfred Spitzer, der har talt og skrevet højlydt om det her siden 2014. Alligevel så fortsætter resten af verden ufortrødent med at automatisere og tale om e-learning og iPads til børnehavebørn.
South Korea, arguably the most digitized country, and definitely the country that produces the most smartphones on the globe. It's Samsung, okay? And a couple of years ago, they had 30% smartphone addicts in their population under 19 and 95% short-sightedness. And we know that addiction and short-sightedness are complications of smartphone use. So they decided we have to do something about this, and they introduced a law. So by a law, if you buy a smartphone in South Korea now, there has to be software installed on the phone, making sure that you can't access pornography and severe violence. You if you use your smartphone for too long time, your parents get notified automatically. Take better care of your kid. It spends too much time on the smartphone, and the access to video games is cut by midnight, so you can't play all night. Okay, so this is at least an attempt by the world's economy, who's depending most on smartphones and who's doing well on smartphones, to protect their next generation from the worst effects of smartphones. And I think we should take note. Even the Chinese Prime Minister a few weeks ago has said we must not use smartphones in schools, because 100 million short-sighted people and 1 billion short-sighted people and 100 million blind people, because short-sightedness can lead in about 10% of the cases to blindness for several reasons. And he said we can't handle 100 million blind Chinese people, so let's get rid of smartphones in every school. And French President Macron also got rid of smartphones in the schools. He probably has read the British study about the smartphone ban in 90 schools that resulted in this clear finding that children get better when they not have a smartphone at school. And there's one more thing. If you do subgroup analysis, that if you look at not at all 130,000 kids in these 90 schools, but you look at the 20% who did worst in school, then the not so good 20%, the middle 20, the good and the very good 20%, and you look how did these people in these groups do after the smartphone ban, it clearly showed that those who did worst in schools benefited the most from the smartphone ban. The very good kids didn't change at all. But by implication, smartphones hurt the not-so-good kids the most. And it's often said, well, we need to digitize to help the poor or to help those who are not so well off to get the same academic attainment as the kids of the academics, okay? To close the gap, as they sometimes, the achievement gap determined by social status or socioeconomic status. Well, this is wishful thinking, ideology-driven. Fact is, it's just the opposite. The more you digitize schools, the more a gap you will have between the children of, well-off parents and the children of not-so-well-off parents. And that's, I think, is the cruel thing about it. Digitization of schools hurts the kids of the have-nots most.
I Sydkorea, verdens mest digitale land, hvor de blandt andet producerer alle Samsungs telefoner, der har de nu lavet en masse restriktioner på smartphone-brug. Du kan ikke spille computerspil efter midnat, der er filtre på indhold, og staten de sender simpelthen forældrene beskeder, hvis deres børn bruger telefonerne for meget. Når Sydkorea gør det, så hænger det sammen med en anden effekt af smartphones hos børn. Det er nærsynethed, der på længere sigt kan medføre decideret blindhed, og man har ikke lyst til at hænge på store generationer af stærkt nærsynet eller decideret blinde unge. Og selv hvis vi glemmer nærsynetheden, der angiveligt rammer asiater hårdere end os her i Europa, ja, så klarer børn med massivt smartphone- og computerbrug sig simpelthen dårligere end andre børn. Det er ondt, siger Spitzer.
We've been saying a lot of bad things about computers in general, smartphones in especially. But all in all, there are computers. What kind of... do you say there must be something we can actually use computers for?
Well, of course, that's why we have them. I mean, I have a smartphone and I use a computer simply because medicine and science, and I do both, is impossible without doing computers. We have computed tomography. By definition, this is done on a computer, okay? And you wouldn't have all these wonderful images that we use on a day-to-day basis to diagnose illnesses. We wouldn't have any of them without computers. So we use computers a lot for our benefit. I mean, we book airline tickets, we shop digitally. We do a lot, and most of it is convenience, but some of it is dearly needed, because it wouldn't go do at all without computers, okay? Even life and death things wouldn't go smoothly without computers. So we need that. But what helps us adult people run the economy smoothly and solve a lot of problems is not by definition the best thing to teach babies, kids, and adolescents. Okay? Once you have a developed brain, like a developed eye, you and I, we could look at a smartphone for 24 hours a day. It wouldn't hurt our eyes. We wouldn't get short-sighted, okay? Because our eyes are developed. Same thing with brain development. Once your brain is fully developed, you can use digital media as tools to achieve all kinds of goals. But if you interfere with proper brain development by doing a lot of mental stuff, not in your brain, but in a computer, this will hurt your brain in developing, okay? On top of it, if you spend social time on a screen, you can't learn empathy, because with learning empathy is like learning to walk and to talk. You need a lot of interactions where another person speaks but also behaves, has a melody of speaking, has facial features such and such, and a way of posting and moving of such and such. So if you had thousands of these interactions, you can look at the person and you know how the person feels, but you've learned that. That doesn't come by birth, or it doesn't come on its own. You have to learn it. You can't do that in front of a screen in Facebook or Twitter or so, okay? So if you outsource your social behavior to screens, you can't learn empathy. And it's known by now that the more adolescents use screens, for every hour more screen use, they have less empathy for their parents and their peers. That has been found in the largest scale study on adolescence and empathy development. Okay. And so we have also long-term studies on the development of empathy in the Western world, and it turns out for 40 years it goes down. And it's so bad that in Germany we have now cases where people are lying on the street and after an accident, and people will stop their car, take a picture, and then drive on, okay? And this is what happens often. Police writes about it, and I think it's a terrible thing that people start doing. In fact, in Germany we have discussed a law recently. The law simply states you don't film a dying person. Because somebody has filmed a person who was dying after a motorcycle crash. Just a passerby took his smartphone out and filmed the person dying and put this on the web, okay? And now we are going to have a law that forbids that. And my argument is the fact that we need a law to forbid the obvious. That is, you don't film somebody dying. If you happen to be near, you help the person, okay? You care about him. Tells us how morally decayed Germans already are, that we need a law. I mean, we had film cameras for 100 years. We didn't need the law. Now we need it because empathy seems to have declined to quite an extent.
Computeren er ekstremt praktisk til at booke flybilletter og udføre videnskab på, og der er masser af liv- og dødssituationer, der er helt afhængige af dem. Men det er ikke per definition det bedste at gøre ved børn og unge. Der er ingen problemer ved at bruge smartphones og computer, når ens øjne er færdigudviklet og hjernen er dannet, men ikke for børn. De kan ikke lære at være mennesker på Facebook og Twitter. Jo mere skærmbrug, des mindre empati. Det er der store studier, der viser, siger Spitzer, der blandt andet fortæller, at man nu er nødt til at lave love, der forbyder, at man filmer døende personer. En lov, der kom oven på en mand i Tyskland, der havde filmet en døende motorcyklist på en motorvej og lagde det hele på nettet uden at hjælpe. Men hvad skal almindelige mennesker gøre for at passe på deres børn? Svaret er kort og kontant. De skal lade være med at give dem skærme.
You have children yourself. What kind, if you should give out some rule of thumb for screen use, what would you say should be?
I'm happy to give out a few rules of thumb, yes. If you have small kids, get rid of everything that has a screen, including TV. Just everything. Second, if you take out your smartphone during dinner, your kids will eventually do the same thing, and you don't want that, so don't do it yourself. You are the role model for your kids, so if you do something that you don't want them to do, you must not do it. It may be hard, but that's just how it is, okay? What you don't give to your kid for Christmas, you don't have to forbid the day after Christmas and from then onward until the child gets out of your house. So don't give out a PlayStation, smartphone, tablet, computer, because there's no way to, once it's out, to get the genie into the bottle back. Okay, and once it's out, you will have to fight over this use all the time. So the thing I can recommend is just say no. If kids say, I want a PlayStation, I want a smartphone, just say no, and the kid will, when the kid is 20 or over 20, it will say, thanks, Dad, thanks, Mom, I see my colleagues and they have done worse once they got this, and you did better to me, thanks. That's going to happen, I'm absolutely sure. I know this for myself, and I know this from so many people who walked up to me. Thanks, Dr. Spitzer, your books and your talks have helped me to withstand the temptation to give out the screen media to my kids. And by now they are 20, and they have been very grateful to me for having done that to them.
How about the people who has already given in to the temptation of giving their children smartphones or tablets for gifts at Christmas?
Oh, just note how detrimental the effects are on health, on education, and make sure that the use is certainly restricted as much as possible. So half an hour a day is probably fine. In fact, we have no study showing what is the least amount that is not harmful. We don't know if there is a threshold or even if a little bit can do harm. But what we do know is that we... most of the time it's hopelessly overdosed given screen media uses of several hours a day, and that is definitely going to impair your child and have it not grow to its full potential.
Vent med at give børnene adgang til skærmen til de mindst 18-20 år, siger Manfred Spitzer, og tilføjer, at nu hvor det snart er jul, så skal man lade være med at købe PlayStations, iPads og smartphones til ungerne. For har de først fået en, så skal man nemlig slås med den dims resten af barndommen. Og det er en svær kamp, siger Spitzer, der understreger, at de voksne i øvrigt selv har et gigantisk ansvar for ikke at tage telefonen frem, mens børnene er i nærheden.
One of the things you are very worried about is Google and the ability to search easy access to information. Why is that a problem?
Well, you need knowledge in order to use a search engine. If you don't know anything, you can sort out the truth from the falsity that Google provides you whenever you Google something, okay? And people always say, well, we need not know anything, we can Google everything. But again, in order to use Google, you need to have pre-existing knowledge, and this knowledge has to be there already, okay? So... when it comes to this, the acquisition of such knowledge, we can ask, how do you do this best? And they have studied this. They gave pieces of information to groups of people, and the information came by book, journal, or newspaper, or by Google. And it turns out when you Google something, the likelihood that it sticks in memory is least. So Google is the worst medium for learning. So once this is clear... and we know that if you have learned something, you can use Google. There's one thing you must not do in schools if schools want to prepare you for using Google. And that is, you should not use Google in schools. That's the best preparation to use Google later on. Because it's not a general knowledge that you acquire, like media literacy or internet knowledge or whatever. No. You need to have knowledge in any domain that you are interested in and that you do a Google search in. And the more knowledge you have in that domain, the better you can use Google. But not knowing anything is really bad and is not the way to become a proper Google user.
Spitzer interesserer sig ikke kun for hjerner. Han har også forsket i neurale netværk og på den måde været med til at have indflydelse på kunstig intelligens. Alligevel er han ikke meget for computer og systemer, som dem Google laver. Du har nemlig brug for viden, før du kan bruge informationer fra for eksempel Google til noget som helst. Uden at vide noget i forvejen, får du intet ud af at bruge digitale medier til at forsøge at lære noget. Det bedste er at lære direkte fra en menneskelig underviser, en lærer, eller læse det i nogle bøger. Det giver nemlig meget mere, siger Manfred Spitzer.
Is it impossible to learn anything from reading out of digital media?
It's not impossible, no. What I'm saying is, it's not the best way to learn. So a good way to learn is somebody telling you something, because the person will know you and will kind of gear the telling towards your needs and questions and answers, etc. Second best is a good book. A good book takes you by the hand and introduces you to a subject, gives you interesting examples, does summaries and draws conclusions, etc., etc., etc. The worst thing is you type in a search term and then you get all kinds of junk mixed with truth in the most mixed bag you can think of. I mean, of course, if you know a lot, you can sort this out quickly and you can get the little bits of truth that you find, okay? So this is the case when somebody in the know uses Google. But somebody not knowing anything, starting on Google, is hopeless. So it's a time-wasting, hopeless enterprise compared to a book or a good teacher. So we should definitely use books and good teachers instead of Google in schools.
Det allerbedste at gøre, det er at bruge lærere til at undervise børn. Det ved vi virker, siger Spitzer, men det er jo meget godt, han mener det, når verden i det hele taget går den anden vej. Ikke mindst her i Danmark, hvor vi har gang i dyb digitalisering, telemedicin og e-learning med kunstig intelligens. Danmark er endda i gang med at lave såkaldt digitaliseringsklar lovgivning. Hvad mister vi, ifølge Manfred Spitzer, ved det, spørger jeg ham. Og svaret lyder, at vi kommer til at replikere og forstærke og gentage alle de fejl, vi allerede selv som mennesker begår via kunstig intelligens. Og at vi risikerer at miste os selv, udelukkende fordi der simpelthen ikke findes en 100% sikker computer. Danmark er et tillidssamfund, siger han, og jo mere man fjerner menneskelig kontakt mellem borgerne og staten og erstatter den kontakt med maskiner, desto mere vil tilliden til staten falde.
Well, this kind of progress comes with the danger that if you use machine learning to extract the deep meaning of, let's say, law judgments and things like that, then you will reproduce every human failure that has entered into those judgments up to the time that you use this database for training the computers. So it has already been shown that if you train computers to judge, let's say, loan applicants to do risk assessment, well, then in the U.S., if you are black, you pay a higher percentage of interest because you're riskier, because black people on average are less well off than white people. And since the computer extracts this information, even if you are white and live in a black neighborhood, the computer will know the neighborhood and will give you a higher interest rate than if you are a black in a white neighborhood. So a computer with machine learning will basically replicate all the biases, all the misconceptions and the prejudices that already exist in society. And nobody would want that, okay? So we have to be much more advanced than we are now in order to get that done. I know that Estonia, they are the most digital advanced state now, and you can have digital statehood and all that. But I also do know that if they would suffer from a cyber attack, that could eliminate the entire state, because it's only on a computer. They have a backup in Luxembourg, yes, but nonetheless, it's quite risky because everything that was set up digitally has by now been broken in. There's no such thing as a 100% secure computer. And since we know that, we shouldn't go and digitize things so quickly. In particular, also given that the more interactions we do digital, the less real life interactions we have, that causes a decrease in the general level of trust within a society. And given the Danish society is a high trust level society. I mean, it's working a nice, a very livable and likable society because there is a lot of trust between people. And politicians should know that if you decrease the amount of personal interaction, you decrease the amount of general trust in foreign, in other people, in people you don't know. And societies live on that basic trust. And you must not take the risk of wasting this away. And that's, I think, is an important consideration that hasn't been mentioned often when it comes to, oh, let's digitize this and this and this and this. The more we digitize something, the less we have that something personalized. And it's the personal interaction that makes, that gets our society going and, in the end, makes people happy. People are not happy interacting with computers. They are happy interacting with other people.
Mennesker kan ikke lide at interagere med computere. Vi kan lide at interagere med andre mennesker. Og hvis vi ender med at erstatte staten med en computer, så får vi et rent orwelliansk samfund, som i øvrigt vil være totalt defekt. Ideen om kunstig intelligens og overførsel af bevidsthed til computere, den er jo et latterlig, mener Manfred Spitzer. Vi overvurderer teknologien helt vildt. Og vi undervurderer os selv, mennesker, og det vi kan.
Well, as long as there are human beings, there will be human-made errors. And I think we have to deal with human-made errors in all respects in our society. And and there are still going to be human-made errors when machines do the decisions, because again the machines' decisions will be based on huge data sets of human decisions, and there will be errors in those data sets, and they will be reproduced. So as long as you do achieve this goal of digitization with the means of today's machine learning, etc., then you will have a problem. If the idea is you do artificial AI, that is, you write a program, and that program is the state, okay? So it's not a computer learning, it's you write out every problem that could possibly exist, and you figure out a solution in advance, and you write it this into the program that then runs the state. That's an Orwellian idea, and I think so far it has never worked, and I wouldn't be optimistic in saying in 5 years from now we are there. Maybe in a very long, far-out future we will get there, but personally I doubt it, because human beings have come up with ever more new problems, and it's impossible to now see and correct every problem and mistake that's going to happen now and in the future. That's, I think, by definition, almost impossible. So it's an interesting idea, but it's a non-workable idea.
We have these people from the Singularity University, Ray Kurzweil and stuff, who believe that we will have very smart computers by 2050, where they will be so smart that they will kind of outrun human beings. And some of these people are also them who are driving the current development in many ways. How do you see the kind of society the singularity people are working towards?
Well, I don't buy anything into this transhumanistic movement, as it's called, because they also say that we'll download our mind into the cloud and then live forever, which is simply not possible. I'm a brain researcher, and I know that a lot of the assumptions that these people do are just not grounded in any reality. And it's not just my imagination that's limited, they might say. I'd say, look, there are in many technological domains, there are times of fast growth in space. There was this the 60s, where from a small satellite they went to a man on the moon walking, okay? That was just 10 years where all the development was done. But then, interesting thing is, it got stuck. I mean, 50 years later, we still had a man on the moon, and then we try hard to get another man on the moon. We don't have even a timeline by now for that to happen, okay? And then back then, they talked about, now we have done the moon, let's go to the planets and other stars. And this all didn't happen. And why? It's very simple. Because they are just way out too far, okay? So let's get at minds and computers and thinking computers. Well, 20 years ago, Kasparov was beaten by Deep Blue, okay? 18 years later, the best Go player was beaten by a computer that was trained in playing Go and learned how to do it and then played beat the very world's best Go player. So this is one board game to the more complex or the world's most complex board game. That took 18 years, okay? And now people say, oh, well, we'll have done medicine and the law within a couple of years. Hey, so from one board game to another one, 18 years, and then they say we'll have just a few years more for doing medicine and law, which is a gazillion times more complex than anything that any board game, okay? So I think they underestimate the complexity of human life, and they overestimate the power of the brain tools that we have in order to record brain activity, recreate brain activity in a computer, etc., etc. And both the underestimation of life's complexity and the overestimation of our brain-wise technology capabilities leads to these completely outrageous transhumanistic claims that are not going to materialize in any future that we can think of now.
When you walk around in the world and tell the things you do, you probably get called a lot of things like you are Luddite. And if we look at what you're saying, it might seem like you're trying to set back the world, saying, are you going to put us into the Stone Age or put us 50 years back or something? What are your reactions to that? Because you must meet it a lot.
Well, if you don't like the message, you shoot the messenger. That what happens to me often. I've been called the apocalyptic psychiatrist or the Dagobert Duck or who. I mean, I've been called names quite a lot. But I don't want to go backwards. No, I want to. In my view, it's more like this. We are currently doing a large-scale experiment on 7 billion people without any ethics committee decisions on how to do it, without any scientists taking data, but we're just doing the experiment, and the outcome by now is pretty bad. And we see that it's going to be much worse in the near future. And in particular, the biggest chunk of the hardship is taken up by kids and adolescents. We are hurting them most. We don't hurt any retired people. Their brains are developed. No, we hurt our youngsters the most. And so what I want is that I want to raise awareness about the risks and side effects of smartphones. That's all I want to do. And then if we are responsible, we can take care of ourselves and use them responsibly. And we have to take care of the younger, who are not by definition responsible for themselves. And we have to take responsible decisions what they are to do and what we probably should not allow them to do, or we should not give out to them. Hey, it's Christmas soon, so please don't give out PlayStations, smartphones, laptops or tablets to children and adolescents, because it's going to hurt them. And once you know this, you can do your own decision making, and you hopefully will, because it's irresponsible not to think about the risks and side effects and just give this out to kids and just cross fingers and hope for the best. That's not going to work.
Sjæl til alle. Hvem der så end måtte være, inklusive pressen og hvem der ellers lytter på politiets radio. Frem af motorvejen, der går en mand fra Vejlands Allé ud mod forgrening. Man går på kørebanen, det mås man ikke. Og det er alle dem, der aflytter politiets radio. Både politikøretøjer og andre. Amager Motorvejen og en mand går på vejen. Slut.
6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and.
Det var altså Manfred Spitzer, hvis bog Digital Demens for nylig udkom på dansk. Han fortalte, at han er vant til modvind og beskyldninger om at være maskinstormer og overdrevet negativ. Det vi også her på aflyttet, som er forbi for i dag. Teknikken stod Jesper Vest for, producer var Annette Birk, og jeg hedder Anders Kjær Ulf. Vi vender naturligvis tilbage i næste uge med mere nyt fra det gennemdigitale overvågningssamfund, som vi alle sammen bor i. Her hvor børnene danser om smarte træer, der tæller hvert skridt og hver en snublen og autotuner os ind i en sort, pulserende, død stjerne, der suger alle gaverne ind i sig og pakker dem ind og ud igen og igen, og garnet strammes, og vi bliver mere og mere stille, mens vi drømmer om sandheden i en sjæl og et legeme. Det bliver ikke lige nu, men måske om lidt.
Du lytter til Radio 24/7.